maybe it's a way of respecting nature. So we dress up, we're going into the cathedral of the forest, and why are we wearing like our gym shorts and, you know, some Nike shoes?
From Wyoming Public Media, this is The Modern West. I'm Micah Schweitzer. From ranches to rigs, this podcast tells stories of the West as it is. And on this episode, we'll follow trails in the snow and have adventures in the woods as we meet Wyomingites outdoors. Let's begin by joining Wyoming Public Radio's Caroline Ballard as she follows a group of hikers into the wild. But these aren't just any hikers. They're probably some of the most fashionable people to take to the trails in the Laramie Range.
On Easter Sunday, six hikers tumble out of cars and gather at the east trailhead of Turtle Rock, east of Laramie.
This is the fourth high society hike that's been in the works. The other three have occurred in Oregon, so this is the first in Wyoming, so congratulations. You should feel special.
They are special, because these aren't ordinary-looking hikers.
We're not in the, you know, spandex like those other ladies over there.
Oh, no. These hikers are wearing dresses, knickers, vests, and suit jackets. They've accessorized with rope, vintage binocular cases, bow ties, felt hats, kerchiefs, and leather-sheathed knives.
It's cool. It's sharp.
They look like characters out of a Jules Verne novel or a Tintin book.
In my mind, there's like several narratives we can go through. Like Jeff, the sinister evangelical preacher from the 20s, like weans me away from the bottle.
Well-dressed playfulness in nature. That's the whole point of the High Society Hiking Club. Chuck Adams is the group's founder, and he got the idea from a hike he did in Italy. He says after seeing women on the trails there in heels and dresses, it got him thinking.
Well, maybe it's a way of respecting nature. So we dress up, we're going into the cathedral of the forest, and why are we wearing, like, our gym shorts and, you know, some Nike shoes?
Thus, the High Society Hiking Club was born. There are some guidelines. No synthetic materials, no smartphones, not even digital cameras. If you want to take pictures, you better have some good old-fashioned film on hand. Their gear resembles things modern hikers use, just with some slight modification. So they've got water, but it's in glass bottles with corks. They have some exercise and meditation equipment, like Chinese medicine balls.
Yeah, I did. The instructions are kind of
cool. And of course, there are plenty of snacks for a picnic.
I brought two bars of chocolate. I baked some cookies. Macadamia nut cookies. I have coffee spiked with almond liqueur.
After all, this is a classy event, and libations are always welcome. They spend almost 3 hours circumnavigating Turtle Rock, a hike that usually takes 1 hour. There's no rush. They stop several times to climb on rocks, explore beaver dams, and contemplate nature before squelching back onto the trail's mud. Chuck asked everyone to bring something special to share, so as they round one of the last turns, they pass around old photos, recite poetry, and tell stories.
Okay, said the bird. So TJ and Jeff jumped on the bird's back and took off. It was about a 10-minute ride. Then TJ yelled, "Stop!"
The High Society Hiking Club may have some rules, but it values one thing above all others.
The only other thing I ask is just uphold the ideals of nature. Whatever you interpret that.
Especially if that interpretation includes looking fabulous. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Caroline Ballard.
Okay, with ski season approaching, let's hear the story of a young climbing and skiing guide who, in a Jackson bar, took on a dare from his friends. The year was 1971. The man was Bill Briggs, and the challenge was to be the first person to ski the 13,766-foot Grand Teton from the top. His friend Spark M. asks him to describe the experience.
So what was your first impression of Jackson?
Well, the first impression was up on Togarty Pass. And boy, the view of the mountains was staggering. Just staggering to me. We're going to climb those? You know, man. And we sure got a feel of the people. So different from the East. In the East, you were always sort of being challenged or something. It was a suspicious environment that I grew up in. And here was a trusting environment. And that really impressed the living daylights out of me.
Did you come up with this idea yourself to ski the Grand?
It was just pushed along. And you're in an environment in with personalities that were encouraging. It was sort of expected. You keep going. I'd like to tell the story of being in the Shady Lady Bar at Snow Canyon. We're sitting around the table and I'm saying the Grand could be skied, and they said, no, it's impossible. Couldn't be done, so I had to do it. That was the final straw. The next thing was to go do it. So basically I was alone, which is okay. I've only got myself to take care of here. And doing something that's that far out, I was happy to do by myself.
So what happened? You're on the top of the mountain.
Oh, on top?
Mm-hmm.
Boy, the problems that you have. In those days, you didn't have plastic straps to hold on crampons. They were leather. You get to the top of the mountain, you have to take the crampons off. Now, getting the right one off, I have to do behind my back. Normally you can just reach down, but I can't reach the foot to the fused hip. So I have to do this behind my back. And I find out the strap is frozen. Now you have to warm up the hand and then unfreeze the strap and go back and forth that way half a dozen times. Finally get the strap off. Now you get the crampons off and you're on a crusted surface and you can put on the downhill ski. Now when you go to put on the uphill ski and you lean over and there is no flat ground, all you have is this rounded egg shape at the top of the mountain. You go down to put the other ski on, and the one that you're standing on starts to go forward around the egg. To get the second ski on was a real challenge. I mean, that's really difficult. Then skiing down, that's easy. Very tight in between the rocks off the summit. It's very narrow going on a hard crust and just wonderful, fun skiing. I must say, I mean, I thoroughly enjoyed fitting the skis through on that. I know I'm going to break through the crust at some point, who knows when. And when the skis do break through, I fall over downhill and you roll over and get right back up again. It's a non-stop action, which I'm used to doing. No problem, zip right back up. And ski down Petzold Ridge, and it's narrowing. It's got a cornice on one side, rocks on the other. The snow is perfect, skis are perfect. I mean, the whole thing is just, you know, how could it be any better? And then you go out on the east face. The east face, I know, is going to slide. The thing is to pick the exact place where the slide will break off. I had spotted just where I wanted to go on the way up. So it was a matter of cutting across and making sure it would slide. So I cut across and boy, it slid just perfect. And you just back up a little and ski down where it had slid off. So all the snow had gone by the other guys down below waiting. And they figured I was in that. When I go down, I do the final bit through that narrow, steep, narrower than my skis were long. so you didn't have much room. Skiing through, and the tails of skis hit on a right-hand turn, hit the rocks. No great problem, but that was a really tricky thing to pull off. That's the big challenge. Skiing through there, I don't know many, if anybody, has since done it. They all rappel that. I didn't have a rope. I couldn't rappel it. I had to ski it. So ski down, pull up behind the other guys, and they weren't even looking. I pull up, where did you come from? The rest of the way down, wonderful adventure. Good corn snow, but a pretty bad runnel. Skiing across the runnel, I started a bit of a slide, and the other guys are down below me, so you roll over and put one ski tip in, bury it in the slide, and the slide stops, and that stops the avalanche from going.
So what happened when you were walking down the end of this?
Oh, on the trail down. Yeah, you get down on the trail, you came across a couple that were coming up, and yeah, they asked, where have you, either you've been skiing, yeah, so where did you ski up on the Grand Teton, for how high up from the top, how many times? You know, just once. Oh, that's too bad.
So, Bill, when you got back to the bar, the Shady Lady or wherever, then what?
No one would believe it. No one would believe it that night. So the next day I go up to the airport and I could see the tracks from the airport. Without binoculars, I could see tracks up there. So I called up Ginny Heidi Cooper at the guide. And she said, stay right there, I'll come up and we'll go take a picture of it. And the picture's been a wonderful thing.
That's the father of extreme skiing, Bill Briggs, talking with his friend Spark M. The story was produced by Cordelia Zars and Samuel Sanders. In May of 2014, Sasha Johnstone became the youngest person ever to climb and ski the Grand Teton. He was accompanied by his parents, who are both Olympic athletes. Family friends Greg Collins, who's a mountain guide, and David Gonzalez, a photographer and writer, tagged along, and David talked with Sasha about the feat.
My dad and mom, they were both in the Olympics. I guess they moved to Jackson Hole and they wanted their kids to be skiers. So they got us on skis when we were really young.
How old were you when you started skiing?
I was like 1 year old. Like I couldn't even walk.
You couldn't even walk?
No, my dad would just hold me there with the little plastic skis.
How old were you, would you say, when you started first thinking that, like, even like talking about skiing the Grand with your dad?
I was probably around 9 years old.
Really?
Yeah.
Was your attempt last year, was that the first time that you had ever skied in Grand Teton National Park?
Yes, it was.
It was?
Yep.
How did you feel about trying again?
Well, I mean, after that, I didn't want to try again. I was so tired, but I knew we were going to next year.
During the ski year, were you preparing for this at all? Were you training for it? Or what did you do to prepare?
This whole ski season, I was in Park City, Utah, skiing park and pipe. And then the whole family, we went to France and Switzerland, and we skied part of the Haute route.
Oh, wow.
And I guess that was like a pretty good step closer to skiing the Grand, because it was just as much work or even more.
Just as much work in what way?
Like, just it was a long day of hiking and skiing in the backcountry.
So on the first day, we left the trailhead in Grand Teton National Park on the valley floor, and we went up to Jackson Hole Mountain Guides High Camp. We started at 8 in the morning, and we got there, what, around 2 o'clock in the afternoon?
Yeah, I would say.
And went to bed at around 9 o'clock or something, yeah. I remember, when it was still a little bit light.
We ended up getting up around 1 o'clock, 1:15. We headed out at like 2:30, 2:45. It's pitch black. All you're doing is following the person's footsteps that's in front of you, and you can't really see anything. And when the sun comes up, you're pretty much up there.
It's a crazy thing, isn't it, to be hiking up that steep, rock-hard glacier in the middle of the night and in your crampons, huh?
Yeah, it is.
Tell me about those first turns off the summit.
It felt really good to be skiing.
Did you hear when your dad said, "Hey, slow down a little bit"?
No, I didn't.
Sasha clicked into his skis on the summit, and we're all like, "It's not. That's actually not the hardest or steepest part, right? That's actually fairly mellow, but still, you are at the very top, and it's scary below that." And Sasha clicked into his skis and made like 3 fast turns, and was so out of there so fast before any of us could say, "Hey, slow down a little bit." Tell me what happened after you after we skied down a bit and you understood that the snow was a little bit scarier or funky.
Well, at that point we were right above the sneak, so my dad decided, "All right, let's put the rope on so we can ski on belay."
How did those turns feel? Because those are the steepest turns, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, I mean, it was icy and I didn't really like the snow, but I mean, it just was skiing, so just had to make normal turns. Oh, and then I got really nervous when that guy almost hit me and Greg.
That was a really horrible moment, actually. What happened is there was a guy by himself who'd gone up to ski the Grand, and he seemed really capable because he was moving really fast on the way up. And we started skiing down, and we kind of passed him, right, on the way down, because he didn't ski the very top for some reason.
Yeah, he was kind of down climbing.
He was down climbing the summit block because he didn't like that. And then he skied down behind us, and he was making a turn in the Ford Couar, and his ski tails washed out, and he went down, and he started sliding. And he started sliding towards Sasha and Greg in the Ford, which is a place that you do not want to start sliding, because it's the void. What you're really skiing, the part of it that you're really skiing when you ski the Grand, is the top east face, and it's massive exposure on every side because it's like cliffs of 1,000, 2,000 feet on every side at that point, which means that no fall is allowed. You can't fall.
I was just thinking, like, I wasn't really thinking about anything else but making good turns and focusing on where I'm going and, like, being cautious of what's around me, pretty much.
We actually didn't even wait for it to soften up, did we?
Yeah, we didn't. Well, we sat up there and ate some snacks, but then we started going kind of right away.
Well, I mean, I think we didn't wait because we didn't want the snow to start softening up and really start coming down.
Oh, yeah, because there was a ton of people below us, and if they were above us and it was super soft, then they would have been knocking a bunch of slush down that trench.
Right.
And it would have just went right down the couloir straight onto us.
Totally. Yeah, it was actually kind of a crowded day on the Grand Teton. The Grand Teton is getting more crowded every year. And it is amazing, like, nobody has gotten hurt doing it. Do you think that skiing the Grand is something that you'll do again?
I hope to, but not soon.
I'm right with you. I'm right with you.
When did you first start thinking about skiing the Grand, David?
I was lucky enough to ski the Grand 11 years ago, almost to the day that we did it, with Doug Coombs and Bill Dyer. And that earlier that year in 2003, I skied in France too. That seems to be a really good way to prepare, because that terrain is in the French Alps is good preparation. It's scary and steep and technical. So I had gone to France and skied over there for a month with Doug Coombs and his wife Emily and their friends. And so I came back, and that's at the time that they were trying to figure out if they could guide the Grand. And so, and Doug was fighting for the right to guide the Grand for Exo Mountain Guides. And so he brought me along basically to show that he could take somebody who wasn't completely prepared. and ended up, we skied the original Bill Briggs route, which is the full Stettner couloir, and had an amazing time and went really well. So it's scary. It's a nerve-wracking adventure. But when I had the opportunity to do it again with you and your dad and your mom and Greg, it just seemed like too good to pass up.
Sasha Johnstone, the youngest person ever to climb and ski the Grand Teton at 13,766 feet. Rebecca Huntington and Samuel Sanders produced the story. As winter rapidly approaches, the days grow shorter, the nights grow longer, and people begin to anticipate snowfall. And with snow, of course, comes the promise of slippery road conditions. For most, this marks the end of the cycling season. But for the dedicated few, winter marks the beginning of an entirely different cycling season, snow biking. However, the rise of this new sport has been met with resistance. Wyoming Public Radio's Willow Belden has the story.
It's a Saturday evening. Light snow is falling, and several dozen people are milling about at the Snowy Range ski area. They're bundled up with thick coats and hats, and they've brought their fat bikes. These are kind of like mountain bikes, only with really wide tires designed for snow. Tonight, there's a race, the first snow bike race that's been held in southeast Wyoming.
3, 2, 1, go! Big lap!
Evan O'Toole organized the race. He says more and more people are snow biking these days, and with good reason.
Basically, if you live in Laramie and you like to ride your bike, it increases your riding time by 100%. Previously, you could only ride your mountain bike on trails for maybe 5 or 6 months out of the year.
Snow biking is a new sport. Fat bikes have only been commercially available for a few years, but Dewey Geigos, who owns the Pedal House Bike Shop in Laramie, says they're already starting to be a big deal. He expects to sell at least 8 or 10 fat bikes this year, and with price tags starting at $1,700, he says that helps his shop survive during the long Wyoming winters.
My first year, almost 2 years, winters were pretty rough. It's not like they're easy cheesy now, because fat biking is not that huge of a sport, but it definitely fills some gaps.
But not everyone is enthusiastic. On a recent morning, Gallegos invited me to give snow biking a try.
All right.
It's slow going, but much smoother than mountain biking.
It's just so peaceful.
But toward the end of the ride, when our trail crosses a Nordic ski trail, a grooming machine approaches. It slows, and the groomer gives us a piercing stare. I later found out he was concerned because our bikes had left ruts on the groomed trails. He's not alone in that concern. Snow bikers have a hard time plowing through deep powder, so they tend to ride on trails that have been packed down by snowshoers or groomed ski trails. Christy Boggs is president of the Medicine Bow Nordic Association and coaches the UW ski team. She says when the snow is firmly packed on the trails, the snow bikes barely leave a trace. But under certain conditions, they can be a problem.
If it's fresh snow, then the snow bikes make ruts. You can get caught in one, kind of like a cattle guard or something, you know, and it can grab you and throw you off.
Boggs says neither she nor her team members have had problems with the bikers, but there have been some incidents.
I know of at least one really solid wreck from somebody who really, really knows how to ski, nationally ranked master skier.
Ski instructor Judy Holm has additional concerns.
If a bike was going the wrong direction on a trail, it would be difficult for a skier and a biker to avoid each other, and there could be some real safety concerns with that.
She says the stakes are higher if a skier collides with a biker as opposed to another skier.
Here you have a person who is just a person colliding with a piece of machinery that's steel, and snow bikes are heavy. They're maybe around 30 pounds.
Skier Larry Foyanini says the solution is simple.
I would just not like to see the fat bikes on the groomed trails.
Foyanini says he's not anti-bike. He and many other skiers are avid cyclists in the summertime.
And I think it's really cool that people are out there on bikes in the wintertime. But there's a there's a place for them.
He and many other skiers think that place should be the snowshoe and backcountry trails, not groomed trails. But Christy Boggs with the Nordic Association and many in the biking community say they'd like to see a cooperative agreement rather than an all-out ban. Evan O'Toole, who organized the Fat Bike race, says snow bikers just need to be educated about how and when to use the groomed trails.
When used responsibly, the bikes don't have any impact on the trails, or no more impact than skis do.
O'Toole and the local bike shops are working to spread the word about trail etiquette, urging riders to avoid groomed trails when conditions are soft and to respect skiers. But tempers are still flaring. Online fat bike forums are filled with posts about skiers telling bikers to get off the trails. One cyclist even found a derogatory comment scrawled in the frost on his car window. The problems are not specific to Laramie. Nordic ski areas across the country are grappling with similar issues. Mike Van Abel is president of the International Mountain Bicycling Association.
There are some Nordic ski areas that are not willing to open up their trails to fat bikes, which is fine. And then there are others that are very willing to do so. In fact, I personally enjoyed a ride on Grand Targhee's groomed Nordic trail while people were skiing.
Van Abel says there's no single solution that works everywhere. But with fat bike sales doubling each year, he says it's important for users and land managers to sit down now and hammer out agreements for how to share the trails. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Willow Belden.
Now, despite the rise in popularity of snow biking made possible by those goofy-looking fat bikes, those are my producer's words, not my words, Wyoming's ranking as a cyclist-friendly state dropped last year to a record low. Wyoming Public Radio's Bob Beck reports.
Wyoming's ranking as a bike-friendly state continues to drop. The state ranks 36th after ranking 33rd last year and 11th in 2010. The loss of stature has concerned the director of Wyoming Pathways, Tim Young. He's been speaking with the Wyoming Department of Transportation about the issue, and he joins us to discuss the report.
This report was principally looking at the state level. What is the state doing in terms of the categories of policies and programs, legislation and enforcement, infrastructure and funding?
Now, you were just speaking with the director of the Department of Transportation here in our state and talking with him about this. What are some of the fixes you see out there?
Well, one thing to keep in mind, it's not just YDOT's job to address bicycling and walking. Programs come to them to manage, but there's also a role for the legislature, for example. And the questions I think we can ask looking at this, are there improvements to state laws that might make conditions safer for bicycling and walking? And what changes would be appropriate? Another one that's really a legislative question, is the state investing sufficiently in facilities for communities to build their biking and walking systems? Are they getting the support they need? So that's those questions for the legislature. I think there's a role for Governor Mead as he's looking at state investments in these types of active transportation modes to help realize the benefits. We can document economic benefits, health benefits, and quality of life benefits where communities collaborating with the state have improved their bicycling and walking systems.
Yeah, and I wanted to just follow up on that. I know you did quite a summit on this last year discussing these things, but the findings have been that, the friendly bicycle regulation really does help communities. If people are looking to move to a community, this is a big deal to them.
It's one of those measuring points that new businesses take a look at, and we've actually seen examples of businesses, for example, in Cheyenne, that we're looking for a place to site a business, Lowe's, a big distribution center. And when they discovered the Greenway system Cheyenne has, it was one of those turning points. They said, this is a place we would like our employees to be able to live and raise a family.
Mm-hmm. I have to tell you, Tim, I have never I've done this a long time, and I'm trying to remember if I've ever heard of any bike legislation that's come up before the legislature. I'm sure it's happened before, but it's not been something that you hear committees debate or discuss quite a bit. What would you be looking for from them?
I think there's opportunities for looking at on the legislative side for how are the current laws working for us in Wyoming. For a couple of years ago, the legislature did remove what they call a mandatory side path law, and that now bicyclists, if there's a pathway on the side or the road, they can decide which they feel more comfortable in. So that was one legal legislative change that was made. I think that looking at a complete streets kind of policies is another opportunity where looking when you're designing a road or a street or a highway, considering the needs of all the users that are there. And if it's the bicycling and walking or components and having to address safe crossings for the street, those can be done as a part of an improved policy. And it may not necessarily require a law, but it could certainly be a state policy that the DOT could adopt within the agency.
It looks like funding might be a big thing for maybe it's more of a funding situation to give to communities to develop a...
The communities have benefited greatly by a couple of programs YDOT manages. The Transportation Alternatives Program, it's a federally funded program that YDOT does a tremendous job with creating a community grant program. The communities in Laramie has been one that's received funds, but there's been several dozen communities across the state that have benefited by the transportation enhancements. It used to be called, it's called Transportation Alternatives now, and that builds community greenways, pathways. It can do pedestrian crosswalks and sidewalks. It's been very successful. And looking at ways to leverage those federal funds with some smart state investments in support of our community's needs, I think that's one of the ways we could really see this score climb up in the next couple of years.
Do you see this as a positive thing in the sense that you're at least talking about some of these issues?
Absolutely. I mean, it's commendable that YDOT is willing to take a look critically at their programs, evaluate the best practices that other states are having success with, and to consider the recommendations in this, and the willingness for YDOT to do that, I'm very impressed with. And I think that's my sense is that YDOT's willing to do that. And I hope both on the governor's side and the legislature's side, they can assist in that.
Tim Young of Wyoming Pathways, always a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you, Bob.
That's Wyoming Public Radio's Bob Beck. And that does it for this edition of The Modern West. You can catch our next episode on the third Tuesday of the month. And if you like what you hear, we'd appreciate a positive rating. In the meantime, you can find lots more stories about The Modern West at our website, wyomingpublicmedia.org. Samuel Sanders produced the podcast. Anna Rader is our web editor. The theme music is by Jeff Troxell. And I'm Micah Schweitzer. The Modern West is a production of Wyoming Public Media.